Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With so many new podcasts, how do you find your next obsession? Try Pocket Casts, the free podcast app designed by listeners for listeners. With curated recommendations, discovery is easy and seamless. When you find something you like, just hit play. Find all your favorite shows, old and new, at pocketcast.com or find us in the Apple app or Google Play stores.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janat Jalil, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 19th of March, these are our main stories. Italy announces that nearly 500 people have died from the coronavirus in the last 24 hours, the highest daily number in any country since the outbreak began. In an unprecedented televised address, Chancellor Angela Merkel has described the disease as Germany's greatest challenge since the Second World War. And the World Health Organization says sub-Saharan Africa has recorded its first deaths from the virus.
The best advice for Africa is to prepare for the worst and prepare today. Africa should wake up. My continent should wake up.
Another grim milestone has been passed as the coronavirus pandemic continues to spread relentlessly. More than 200,000 people have been infected. Just 13 days ago, it was half that number. The head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, has called for global solidarity to defeat this unprecedented threat to humanity.
Don't assume your community won't be affected. Prepare as if it will be. Don't assume you won't be infected. Prepare as if you will be. But there is hope. There are many things that all countries can do. Physical distancing measures like cancelling sporting events, concerts and other large gatherings can help to slow transmission of the virus. They can reduce the burden on the health system, and they can help to make epidemics manageable, allowing targeted and focused measures. But to suppress and control the epidemics, countries must isolate, test, treat, and trace.
On Wednesday, the number of deaths in Italy jumped to nearly 500 despite the lockdown imposed last week. It's the highest number of deaths in one day in any nation since the first case was detected in China at the end of last year. In all, nearly 3,000 people have died in Italy. Mark Lowen reports from Rome.
The nationwide restrictions imposed last week seem to have slowed the rate by which cases are increasing. There's talk of stepping up some measures in the worst-hit areas of the north. On the whole, Italians appear to be abiding by the limits on movement, but police say more than 40,000 people were found to be in breach out of a million checked, and 1,500 businesses have broken rules on closure.
Mark Lowen. Well, as you can imagine, in Italy there are tight restrictions in place everywhere. And in the north of the country, hospitals are struggling to cope with the number of critically ill people. Professor Massimo Galli is head of the Infectious Diseases Department at the Luigi Sacco Hospital in Milan. My colleague, James Menendez, asked him if there had been any improvement in the situation on the wards.
Of course, the situation remains a critical one, as you can imagine, because, you know, the number of patients having the need to be hospitalized is increasing, and we are far from the peak of the epidemic, in particular in Lombardy. But as you can imagine, the problem will be a relevant one also in the other part of the country in the next days. And in this kind of situation, we have a sort of tide of patients needing assistance that are arriving in our hospitals. And we work against the law of the physics in order to extend the capacity of our department to be able to admit a lot of new patients. It is a matter of fact that if we are not able to win the Battle of Milano, the situation could be worsening day by day in the next 2 weeks.
And are you able to treat everybody adequately, or are you having to make some difficult choices about who gets ventilators, for example?
In my hospital, we remain able to treat adequately all the patients that we are able to admit. We have a serious problem for the turnover because there are many patients that can be discharged from the hospitals but remain with a shedding of virus still present. And in this kind of cases, I am preoccupied about a correct quarantine out of the hospital. But it is obvious that without the place remain free after the discharge of these patients in good general conditions, we are not able to assist the others.
The UK and the US as well are behind Italy in the curve of the transmission of this virus. What advice would you give to people in your position in those countries, for example? What would you have done differently?
We had a particularly unlucky situation because the epidemic in our country was able to circulate in Italy, in particular in the area of Lombardy around Lodi, for at least 4 weeks before being individuated.
So aggressive quarantine measures now been introduced somewhere like, for example, the UK. Those are the only way to proceed, are they?
It's fundamental to proceed to these kind of measures. Otherwise, no way to try to stop the spread of the infection. Absolutely no way.
Massimo Galli in Milan speaking through a surgical mask. In her first televised address on the crisis, the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, has called it the biggest challenge since the Second World War. She said Germans needed to take the disease seriously. Every life counted, she said, and the number of loved ones lost would depend on how strictly people followed the rules.
I am absolutely sure that we will emerge from this crisis. But how high will the sacrifice be? How many loved ones will we lose? To a large degree, we have the answers in our own hands. We can all now act decisively and together. We can accept the current restrictions and stand together and be there for one another.
I spoke to our Berlin correspondent, Jenny Hill, and I put it to her that this was a highly unusual move by the Chancellor.
Yeah, you're right about unusual. In the, 15 years that she's been leading Germany, she's never made a televised statement like this. She addresses the public once a year on New Year's Eve. Something like this is really quite remarkable. And while you can speculate as to the reason that she's doing it now, my view is that she's pretty keen to get across the gravity of the situation here in Germany. We are seeing a lot of restrictions on public life here, but Germany, the government, has stopped short of imposing a complete lockdown, although I must actually mention that we do now know of a town in Bavaria which has gone into a kind of curfew situation. But, you know, here I'm looking out of my flat window in Berlin and I can see people gathering outside a drinks shop. I think it's quite clear that actually the authorities' message isn't getting through to everyone. People are continuing to get together against the urging of the government. So I think Chancellor Merkel may be trying to get the message to hit home, and by making this rather unusual address, she's doing that. I think she may also be preparing the ground because many people here fear that Germany inevitably will end up imposing lockdowns like we've seen in France, Spain, Italy and so on. The experts here are saying the current measures which have been imposed, they'll know in the next sort of 10 days or so whether they're really working. A lot of people are rather suspicious that we might see rather more drastic action taken sooner.
How would Germans react to that?
Well, I think people here understand the necessity, perhaps. And of course, the advantage, if you want to call it that, is that people have been able to watch what's been happening in countries like Italy, Spain and France. People are very concerned about that. When you wander around Berlin, there is a mixed effect. The streets are much quieter than they usually would be. But then, as I say, you do see people gathering still. The institute which advises the government on the crisis has had to appeal to people not to hold coronavirus parties. So clearly there are parts of society who haven't quite grasped what's happening here. They may resist any kind of lockdown, but of course those measures are much more drastic, and policing them will be very different than the current situation, which relies on people's goodwill, really.
And the situation in Germany isn't as grim as it is in other European nations, because despite a relatively high number of cases, the death rate has been much lower than in places like Italy or Spain.
Yes, you're right. I think we're now looking at something like 11,000 confirmed cases. 25 or 26 people have now died here. Now, no one really knows why the death rate is so low. Some speculate that it's because the people who've initially been tested have tended to be younger and experienced milder symptoms. And actually, a friend of mine who went for a test just today said that the people around her waiting in this mass facility tended to be actually really rather young. So that's one theory. The second theory is that the German health system is very well resourced, well funded. People are well taken care of here. Perhaps it's a slightly healthier society than others. Difficult one to argue without facts and figures, really, but it's another theory. The authorities themselves say they don't really know because the data isn't yet available for analysis, but that they have expected the death rate to rise in line with other countries. A depressing thought, of course, but that as the virus spreads, as it starts to reach more vulnerable elderly parts of the population, then we can expect to see more deaths.
Jenny Hill in Germany. Britain is going to follow the example of other countries by closing schools to try to slow the spread of the coronavirus. They'll shut until further notice from the end of the school day on Friday. Speaking at his daily news conference, the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, said there would be exemptions in England for the children of key workers such as police, delivery drivers and health staff, and also for vulnerable pupils. Here's our assistant political editor, Norman Smith.
The decision to close schools is one the government had desperately sought to delay, but the sheer pace at which this virus is now spreading has once again forced ministers to act. At the weekend, it was suggested there'd be no need to close schools for several weeks. However, the Prime Minister announced they'd shut from Friday, a decision echoed by the governments in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. Nurseries, sixth form colleges, private and boarding schools will be included. A decision taken despite the severe misgivings in government about the impact the move could have on tackling the disease if parents who are doctors and nurses have to stay at home. At his daily news conference, however, the Prime Minister announced there'd be exemptions for certain key workers such as nurses, police officers and delivery drivers.
So we therefore need schools to make provision for the children of these key workers who would otherwise be forced to stay home. And they will also need to look after the most vulnerable children. This will mean that there will, of course, be far fewer children in the schools, and that will help us to slow the spread of the disease. And these measures are crucial to make sure that the critical parts of the economy keep functioning and public services keep functioning.
Mr. Johnson also urged parents not to leave their children with grandparents, as the elderly are more vulnerable to the disease. He also announced that schools would remain closed until further notice. However, all the indications are this could mean they remain shut for many months. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon.
We will, of course, only keep them closed for as long as we absolutely have to. But at this stage, I cannot promise that they will reopen before the summer holidays. We know that this will massively disrupt life, society and the economy. We know that it massively changes family life and nothing is more precious than that. But that indeed is the measure of how serious this virus is.
Today's decision was prompted not just by the spread of the virus, but also by the fact a number of schools, particularly in London, were already choosing to close because so many staff were having to self-isolate. It seems the pace at which the coronavirus crisis is now unfolding is almost forcing ministers to make decisions hour by hour in an effort to slow the advance of the virus.
Norman Smith. The United States and Canada have agreed to close their border to non-essential traffic in a further response to the coronavirus pandemic. The move will not affect trade. The Canadian Prime Minister is Justin Trudeau.
Travellers will no longer be permitted to cross the border for recreation and tourism. In both our countries, we're encouraging people to stay home. Well, this collaborative and reciprocal measure is an extension of that prudent approach.
The US is also ramping up in other ways its fight against the spread of the virus. President Trump announced he was signing into law the Defense Production Act. The president said he was proceeding as if the US was on a war footing. He also said he was increasing hospital beds in two areas of acute demand, in New York and California.
Upon request, the two hospital ships are being prepared right now. They're massive ships. They're the big white ships with the Red Cross on the sides. One is called the Mercy and the other is called the Comfort. They're getting ready to come up to New York. We haven't made the final determination as to where it's going to go on the West Coast.
Mr. Trump's continued description of COVID-19 as the Chinese virus was challenged by a reporter who asked if it wasn't putting Asian Americans at risk by stirring up dangerous prejudices.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China. That's why. It comes from China. I want to be accurate.
Yeah, please, John, please. Are you comfortable?
I have great love for all of the people from our country, but as you know, China tried to say at one point, maybe they stopped now, that it was caused by American soldiers. That can't happen. It's not going to happen. Not as long as I'm president. It comes from China.
I spoke to our correspondent in Washington, Ali Makbul, and I asked him what invoking the Defense Production Act would allow Mr. Trump to do.
It allows him to get companies which produce protective gear, masks and so on that are badly needed, of course, right across the health care system in the US and elsewhere, to produce those goods at record levels, he says, to get them out there as quickly as possible. But it comes, as he calls himself, a wartime president because of those more than 7,000 cases now across the US, with 177 deaths now having been confirmed. Those numbers are likely to rise dramatically in the coming days because finally, after lots of delays, test kits are finally getting out.
And because of those concerns, hospital ships are being dispatched to ensure enough beds.
Yes, they're US Navy hospital ships, one being sent to New York Harbour and one to the West Coast. But he's taken other measures as well to try and ease the burden on those being impacted by all of this. Foreclosures and evictions have been suspended until the end of April. And, you know, there have been other measures that he's talked about in terms of easing economic hardship. But those are things which need to go through Congress, and that is taking time. There are two bills being discussed for a huge economic stimulus package, but also one that ensures, because we still don't have it, a bill that ensures free coronavirus testing and help for those who currently don't get paid sick leave. We are promised that there will be a vote on one of those bills later in the day, but a very stark warning from the US Coronavirus Task Force to say that, as we were hearing from, we've been hearing from other parts of the world, that young people are perhaps being affected more than originally thought, and that it isn't just the sort of at-risk groups that have been defined earlier that should be careful in the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions, but young people too.
Ali Makbul in Washington. Sub-Saharan Africa has recorded its first deaths from the coronavirus. In all, as we recorded this podcast, four people were known to have died. So far, African countries have seen a relatively slow rise in the number of cases, but there are warnings that strained public health systems could become quickly overwhelmed across the region. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, has urged governments across Africa to learn from the experience in other parts of the world.
The best advice for Africa is to prepare for the worst and prepare today. And that's why we're saying we have to do the testing, we have to do the contact tracing, we have to do the isolating. And with regard to mass gathering and so on, it will help if we avoid that. And I think Africa should wake up. My continent should wake up.
In Rwanda, where there are 11 confirmed cases, the authorities have announced that no passenger flights will be allowed in or out of the country after Friday. Despite appeals for calm and restraint, many people seem unable to resist the urge to stockpile. Now measures are being put into place to combat panic buying. Charlotte Gallagher has been looking at the global picture.
Most of us now will have seen photos of bare shelves in supermarkets, and it seems that toilet paper, tin food and cleaning products are the things that people are stocking up on, and they're just buying large quantities of. And in the Netherlands and Belgium, they have an expression for this kind of bulk buying and panic buying. They call it hamster buying. Essentially, as how hamsters fill their cheeks with food, humans are going round and filling their trolleys with food and different products from supermarkets. And this is worrying for the elderly and the vulnerable, for people that can't get out of their houses as much as other people can. So what's being done? Well, Australia's largest supermarket chain, Woolworths, they're having an hour a day just for elderly and disabled people to shop in peace, not worrying that they're going to be pushed over by someone as they run for the pasta and the long life milk. Delhaize in Belgium, they're doing the same thing as well. Some supermarkets in the UK, they're actually introducing rationing, so you can only buy a certain number of products. So you won't be able to buy 10 packets of toilet roll, you'll only be able to buy three. Now, Indonesia, police there are telling shops to ration purchases of staple foods. So things like rice, oil, sugar and instant noodles. And in Walmart in the US, obviously a huge chain there, they're limiting hand sanitizers because, of course, lots of people are trying to buy hand sanitizers.
Charlotte Gallagher. Now, here's my colleague, Jackie Leonard.
All around the world, there are people in isolation in an attempt to limit the spread of the coronavirus. On the face of it, it sounds easy enough, but, well, isolating. You are not, however, alone. You have us and the other Global News podcast listeners. If you are in isolation, send us an audio postcard. Record yourself, tell us who and where you are, and share your one top tip for keeping your spirits up. Then email it to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. We'll keep each other company. Thank you.
Thanks, Jackie. While Europe is at the centre of the crisis, it looks as if China may be over the worst. So Beijing is now sending 2 million surgical masks and 50,000 testing kits to the European Union. The wearing of masks has been a particularly visible feature in the fight against the virus in China and the rest of East Asia. Our correspondent in Seoul, Laura Bicker, describes everyday life there.
People are still using subways, buses. It's not as busy as it normally would be. This is a very social country. Apartments are quite small, so people tend to gather outside. You must wear a mask. People think you're bonkers if you don't wear a mask. And people are trying to stay away from one another and taking precautions. But it's not like life is in lockdown and there's certainly no panic.
So, are masks a priority? Professor Ben Cowling, head of epidemiology in Hong Kong University's School of Public Health, answers that and some other questions about the virus put to him by my colleague Yalda Hakim.
The evidence that we have so far is that it really needs prolonged person-to-person contact, close contact. So that means however it spreads, if we can avoid those close contacts, we can definitely reduce transmission. Whether it's really going through the air or not, it would still be at close range, probably over a longer period of time of exposure. We know on average one person might infect two others. If it was really spreading from people passing each other on the street, we'd see a lot more transmission than we've seen so far.
So we're also told, obviously, to avoid crowded spaces, you know, stadiums and these crowded tubes and subways and things like that. Would that be considered a prolonged period of time if it was sort of, you know, over a journey of 40 minutes or something?
Yeah, I think if that was a long tube right next to someone who was infected and coughing, then you'd be at risk of infection. But if it was a short journey, I think maybe not.
And of course, you know, we're all sort of obsessing about using hand sanitizers and washing our hands because that has become sort of the main advice given on how to prevent this. But touching surfaces, for example, it can sit there for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we think that it does spread through the air. So if you're sitting next to someone on the bus or on the train who's coughing, you're going to get it by breathing in whatever they coughed out. So that's why in Hong Kong, a lot of people do wear face masks. But at the same time, if there was someone who was on the train before you got on and they already got off, but they were touching the handrails and you touched the same handrails, you could infect yourself that way because we do know the virus can survive on surfaces for quite a while.
I mean, we are hearing conflicting advice. There are some who say masks make no difference because, you know, actually taking off the mask, you could reinfect yourself by putting hands on your face.
Well, so, I mean, we know all respiratory viruses spread through the air, and healthcare workers are recommended to wear surgical masks, so they must be doing something. But at the same time, there's a global shortage of surgical masks. I agree with you that if you wear the mask wrong, if you touch it, then actually you kind of waste the mask. You would lose the benefit of the mask. But that's something that could be dealt with by better education.
Professor Ben Cowling from Hong Kong University's School of Public Health. In almost every government response to the emerging coronavirus outbreak, politicians around the world have made a point of saying they are being guided by the science. Yet, with this new virus, many questions about that science remain unanswered. For his assessment of what we still need to find out, here's our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
The world became aware of this virus only in December. Despite incredible effort by scientists, there's still much we do not understand. One of the most crucial questions is also one of the most basic. How many people have been infected? So far, we are seeing just the tip of the iceberg. Developing antibody testing will allow researchers to see whether people have come into contact with the virus. Until then, we cannot be sure how far or how easily the coronavirus is spreading. It's also impossible to get a clear idea of how deadly the virus is without knowing how many are infected. People appear to be most infectious when they develop the first symptoms of cough and a fever, but the full picture of who is infectious and when is still fuzzy. The relationship between the virus itself and our immune system is an urgent field of research. How long does immunity last? Can we get coronavirus twice? How effective will vaccines be? All are important questions that don't have answers. It's also uncertain how effective each of the isolation and social distancing measures introduced to control the spread of the coronavirus will be. This is in part because we don't understand enough about how the virus behaves. We're all now part of a planet-wide experiment trying to find answers.
James Gallagher. Many older people above the age of 70 have been advised to self-isolate as they are the most vulnerable to infection. So what are the challenges of doing this and how does it make them feel? Susie Dugdale is self-isolating in rural Yorkshire in northern England. Her brother has been tested for COVID-19 and is awaiting results, so she's keeping away from her husband, who's been quite ill in the past. She's 73. My colleague, James Menendez, began by asking Susie how she was feeling.
I've been blowing my nose quite a lot, but, you know, that's not unusual. And I feel I certainly haven't got a temperature and I feel fine.
And your brother, have the test results come back?
No, they haven't. And, oh, golly, that's maddening because the test was taken on Monday and the idea was we would know by last night. Well, the test place doesn't appear to have even received it. So that's quite irritating.
Yes, that is a bit frustrating. So, I mean, how's your husband doing? I mean, how are you talking to him?
You know, I'm walking the dogs and I can't cook for him, which is a pity. So, honestly, he won't have eaten hardly anything.
Is he not very good in the kitchen, then?
Hopeless. Hopeless. Boiled egg maximum. But again, Claire and Joe, our son, have sort of given him food and things to keep him going.
And how are you keeping yourself occupied?
I'm a painter, so I'm in my studio and I'm gardening and I'm reading a bit and also doing things rather nicely. So if I have a cup of tea, instead of just shoving a tea bag into a mug, I don't. I've got leaf tea, which I found in the bottom of the cupboard, and I'm making a pot of tea, putting it into a cup and saucer, pouring it out and sitting down and really enjoying it.
Do you feel lucky in the sense that although you can't see as much of your husband as you'd like, at least you know he's there? Plus, as you say, you've got your children who can help out. I mean, I guess this is a much better situation than some people might find themselves in.
Oh, really? Yes, absolutely. But I think one of the things that's made me just really rock with laughter is all the funny videos and things that we seem to keep on sending each other. And, you know, they are very amusing. And it's sort of typical English people, isn't it? How they're actually quite good. They have got a lovely sense of humour and sort of see the sense of the ridiculous. So I think that helps.
What advice, if any, would you give to other people just to sort of try and keep mind and body together in these situations? I mean, do you think the mental thing is in some ways tougher?
Well, it hasn't been for me, but I think I am quite a resourceful person. I've got a life full of love, people who love me and I love them. And also having the dog, it's very, very nice having my dog. If you are interested in anything, really, this is your chance to really self-educate, have a go at it, and to turn it into a positive thing.
Yes, and just one final thought, Susie. Are you worried at all about the virus itself?
If I get it, I actually wondered whether I want to stay alive because of David and because I'm having a wonderful life. But I was wondering if I was really ill and needed to be on a ventilator. I really feel that young people should have a go at it. That's my feeling. And I'm fit and healthy. I take lots of exercise. So I would have thought that even if I get it, I will live to fight another day.
73-year-old Susie Dugdale, who's self-isolating in Yorkshire. A number of athletes have accused the International Olympic Committee of risking their health after it was announced the Games in Tokyo are still scheduled to start as planned in late July. Nigel Adley has been following the story.
With training camps around the world in lockdown and qualifying events cancelled, it's very difficult for athletes to reach peak condition or even reach the Games themselves. The Greek pole vaulter Katerina Stefanidi, who was the reigning Olympic champion, has accused the IOC of risking the health of both competitors and their families by asking them to try and prepare, while the world heptathlon champion Katerina Johnson-Thompson has said it's impossible for her to train because facilities in France are in lockdown. The Paralympics are also due to take place in Tokyo, and table tennis player David Wetherill says the Games aren't his top priority at the moment.
In my personal opinion, we need to try and obviously stop the spread of this virus. Having a biological chemistry degree as well, I don't know whether that makes me a little bit more anxious because I know kind of a little bit more about whatnot and stuff. We've just been told to kind of act as if Tokyo's ahead, going ahead, and people are living in cuckoo land a little bit at the moment because, like I said, sport's not the most important thing at the moment. I am personally quite sceptical and I think it'd be very irresponsible to carry on as normal at this stage.
The IOC say no solution will be ideal and they are committed to finding one with the least negative impact for the athletes' health while also protecting the integrity of the competition. On Tuesday, Japan's Olympic Minister Seiko Hashimoto said a complete Games would be delivered on time and with spectators present. Currently, only 57% of the athletes due to compete have been able to qualify.
Nigel Adley. Many of us will be looking for a little diversion and entertainment in the coming weeks and months. But to the disappointment of its millions of fans, this year's Eurovision Song Contest has been cancelled. A blow for all the acts due to go to Rotterdam for the event in May. But perhaps especially for the Icelandic band Dathi and Gagnac Magnith, which had been seen by many as early frontrunners to win.
When we first met, I will never forget.
Our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd, said the cancellation had been seen as all but inevitable.
The European Broadcasting Union, which runs it, had no choice. Some people were saying, oh, but can't you at least run it without an audience? But firstly, that would have been antiseptic. All the fun would go. And how would you get those thousands of people to Rotterdam to take part and cover it? I know Eurovision is not the most important thing on the planet at the moment, but society needs fun. That Icelandic act was an early favourite precisely because they shot a very funny video, which went viral, with cheesy dance routines. It's a bit of brightness gone for this year anyway.
And sad news about another big music event, which is known around the world. No Glastonbury this June.
Yeah, one of the world's big music festivals down in rural Somerset, south of London. Only a few days ago, the likes of Dua Lipa, Kendrick Lamar and others were going to be the headliners. Glastow now is part of summer in the same way that Wimbledon or cricket is. So we won't get any of those classic Glastow moments like Stormzy's set last year, which people were talking about for days afterwards.
Amen in Jesus' name, oh yes I claim it. Any little bread that I make, I have to break it. Brothers wanna break me down, I can't take it. I done a scholarship for the kids, they said it's racist. That's not anti-white, it's pro-black.
And Vincent, there are many other cancellations coming in now as well.
Oh, I can't tell you as arts correspondent the number of emails I've had in the last 48 hours which contain a phrase like, "It is with heavy heart that we announce the difficult decision not to proceed with." Just to take a few of the world's big art galleries and museums, the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, the Metropolitan Museum in New York, the Louvre in Paris, the Sao Paulo Art Museum in Brazil, all closed. Whether it's Stormzy or the Berlin Philharmonic celebrating 250 years since Beethoven was born, art and performance give us moments of joy. And what, at a time like this, is life without at least moments of joy?
Vincent Dowd. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.